I would like you to welcome you to the migration session of this grand think tank dialogue. And today we're looking at the future of migration and mobility policies within the European Union. We have three fantastic speakers who will all be tackling different aspects of migration policy and migration issues in general. And I am your chair. My name is Elizabeth Collett. I'm the director of the Migration Policy Institute Europe, which is an independent think tank dedicated to the study of migration worldwide. So in that respect, I am a one-trick pony. I just think about migration all day long. And I'm feeling quite nostalgic today. We're here to discuss the future of EU migration policy at a very difficult time. Economic crisis, high unemployment, and uncertainty about Europe's own future has fueled a scepticism not just towards migration, but towards the government's ability to live up to promises about managing migration, public confidence in their government's ability to live up to those. And policymakers in Brussels are now tasked with developing new policies and narratives on migration at a time when proliferating humanitarian crises in the European neighbourhood are really overshadowing all discussions on migration. Today we're talking about migration, but I think in the back of our heads we have to really think hard about the refugee crisis in the neighbourhood of Europe, the asylum crisis, the asylum numbers that are coming to Europe and how well we're managing those, and thinking also about maritime migration as a symptom of the broader dysfunction that we currently have within those dynamics. But as I say, I'm a little nostalgic today because I arrived in Brussels 10 years ago, in 2005. I arrived to be the Eve of old at the European Policy Centre. And the topics our panellists will cover today were as relevant then as they are now. And I think one of our questions is, have we really made progress over the last 10 years? And will we be making progress over the next 5 to 10 years? I say this as the policy plan on legal migration, which was a much heralded plan to develop economic migration policies at the EU level, was published in December 2005, very, very quietly. If you publish something on the 21st December, you really don't want people to read it. And it took 8 to 9 years for that policy plan to be fulfilled through the legislative process. And there are questions as to whether it's had a very real impact. President Juncker has expressed a desire to refocus again on legal and economic migration and rethink our policies on this. But how far have we really moved in the last 10 years, and how difficult it is, will it be to move forward? The global approach to migration, a much vaunted framework for thinking about migration and relationships with third countries on the management of migration, the external dimension of migration management, was very much promoted by the UK presidency of the European Union in the second half of 2005. The Hampton Court European Council said this is something that should be a priority for us. And here we are again in 2015 with the High Representative Mogherini really talking about migration becoming a pillar of foreign policy, really trying to integrate it into foreign policy dialogues, and a renewed focus on how you might do this both coherently and structurally. And again, public scepticism and uncertainty about migration and integration in 2005 was high on the agenda, not least because of the first effects of free movement following enlargement to the UK were starting to create ripples of concern within the British debate, but also riots and unrest in the suburbs of Paris and elsewhere really created a conversation that is strikingly similar to the conversation we've had over the past few weeks about the effectiveness of European policies to reduce marginalisation and promote integration. So in this broader context, we're trying to give you, we don't seem to have moved that far over the last 10 years. So I want to ask our panellists, when they're making their remarks about the future, to perhaps reflect, where have we come from in this context? What is different about now that might allow us to achieve some other goals? And whether we're just having the same conversation over and over again, and possibly how we might break that conversation. So with that in mind, I would like to introduce our first panellist, Matthias Meyer, who is the project manager for the Bertelsmann Foundation. At the Migration Policy Institute, we've had a long and very fruitful partnership with the Bertelsmann Foundation on everything related to migration, and I'm particularly intrigued by their work, which is looking at a fair deal for talent within the framework of the Reinhard Mohn Prize, and I think that your remarks will speak to that. Please.
Thank you very much, Liz. I also think about migration all day long, so I feel I'm in good company. Well-managed migration is a positive force. It can help to deal with a demographic decline. It is a source of innovation. It contributes positively to state finances. It creates cultural diversity. It can improve the standards of living of migrants. And it can foster development in countries of origin. However, in reality, those benefits are often not fully realized, or even there are negative effects, such as exploitation of migrants by corrupt employers, wage dumping in countries of destinations, or brain drain in countries of origins. So those effects can help or can stipulate that create a negative public opinion. So what we actually need is a fair mobility and a fair management of migration at the national but also at the EU level to create those positive effects of migration. And today I would like to give three brief cornerstones of a fair management of migration. So first, the mobility decision of the migrant needs to be up to the migrant. So the Migration Act needs to happen voluntarily and not be forced. So for this reason, residence titles need to be clearly renewable, and temporary migration should only happen in certain situations to fill specific seasonal or specific short-term labor demands. Also, residence titles should not expire in temporary periods of absence of the migrant. So if the migrant decides to go to his or her country of origin for a couple of months or even longer, the residence title in the country of immigration should still be valid. So this can really create a true circular movement that is out of the free will of the migrant and not forced. And finally, on this point, the transferability of social security claims that have been acquired in the country of immigration need to be possible. The second cornerstone of a fair management of migration is that migration policy needs to consider the entire migration cycle. So that is from the selection of the migrant over the preparation of the migrant before the act of migration to the integration and the diaspora engagement in the country of immigration until the potential return or further migration. So what concerns the selection is it's extremely important that there's a matching between the migrant skills and the labor market needs of the country of immigration. So the migrant needs to be able to work according to his or her qualifications, and his or her qualifications need to be recognized in the country of immigration. There need to be pre-departure measures already before the act of migration. So to familiarize the migrant with the culture or the labor market of the country of immigration. So this can happen online or with country offices. So this is, for instance, I think could be a great opportunity for European countries to pool their resources to create some sort of European migration offices in certain countries of origin, such as the Philippines or India. So those pre-departure measures then should be linked to integration measures in the country of destination through, for instance, individualized action plans or mentoring programs. Also, what is very important is that migration routes need to have clear avenues to permanent residency and citizenship to really make it possible for the migrant under certain conditions to really stay in the country of immigration and integrate there properly if he or she wishes to do so. And finally, it is important to encourage diaspora engagement from the country of immigration to the countries of origin, so to increase the developmental impact of migration. So this can happen through networks or databases or mentoring programs to really create more knowledge transfer between the country of destination and the country of origin. And in this wake, also the remittances cost should be reduced. The third and final cornerstone of a fair migration policy are bilateral agreements that supplement national or European regulations. And, for instance, they can take use of the existing framework of the European mobility partnerships that create a great framework for actually more bilateral agreements. So to create or establish bilateral agreements on with clear partnerships between the country of destination and the country of origin, it is important that the partner countries, the countries of origin, are selected according to certain criteria. So those criteria include, for instance, demographic or economic factors of the country of origin, and the stance of the government of the country of origin should be positive towards migration. There needs to be a functioning administration in the country of origin, then the education systems should be compatible between the partner countries, and historical ties between the partner countries help to make a bilateral agreement work properly. And finally, the valorization of migration in the country of origin to certain programs is also very important. And one specific form of bilateral agreements are so-called global skill partnerships that combine a migration side bilateral agreement with actual training in the country of origin. So this agreement should be created in pilot projects, because there's a great chance that they can really enhance the developmental potential of migration. So to conclude, I just presented three cornerstones of a fair migration policy, and I think if we follow these cornerstones, the migration can really unleash its positive potential, and we can avoid negative effects that migration might have, and then really create so-called triple wins in the benefit of the migrant, the countries of origin, and the countries of destination. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I think it's particularly useful to put this in the broader context, that immigration is not just something that happens to Europe, it is done to Europe, but there is a complex interdependency between sending countries, receiving countries, and migrants themselves, and how we behave within those relationships really can affect outcomes. I have one question for you. You talk about bilateral agreements perhaps being a cornerstone of a fair migration policy. At a time when most regions of the world are thinking about regional cooperation, how to cooperate in small groups, whether we're talking ASEAN, the European Union itself, CARICOM in the Caribbean, are really thinking about how to create multilateral cooperation and cooperation then between regions. How do bilateral labour agreements offer an advantage over that multilateralism? Why would you go for what could become a very complex machinery of bilateral arrangements? What advantages does that hold over, say, a regional approach that looks at cooperation amongst a group of countries?
Yeah, I think, of course, we should not concentrate on either or, but I think both kinds of cooperation are extremely important. I think the advantage of a bilateral agreement that can really cater to specific labor market needs of a country of origin or country of destination. For instance, Germany concluded a bilateral agreement with the Philippines, and the Philippines have a very strong health education system, and they have actually an oversupply of health workers, and Germany has an undersupply. So they created like a great agreement that brings Philippine nurses to Germany. So I think this is really like a specific, there's a specific demand and a specific supply. So this agreement is working really well and has a great benefit. But in other countries, it might, the education system might not be as compatible, or there might not be undersupply of health workers. So I think, bilateral agreements can really benefit in specific conditions, taking into account the specific nature of the countries of origins and the country of destination.
Thank you. It's really helpful to understand. Context is key, it would seem. And with that, I'd like to move to our second panelist, Yves Pascal, who is the Director of Migration and Mobility Policies at the European Policy Centre. But he's also, and we have to congratulate him, the founder of a new website that I highly recommend everyone takes a look at, called EuropeanMigrationLaw.eu, which really does bring together all the various laws and analysis on EU migration law. And yesterday was awarded with the European Citizen Prize by the European Parliament for Best New Initiative in 2014. So, Yves, congratulations, and we're curious to hear your thoughts.
Thank you very much, Lise, and thank you very much for your congratulations and highlighting the work I'm doing outside of the EPC as well. In this critical field, EU migration and asylum policies, just for the short minutes we have to discuss those issues, I just want to respond to your introduction and perhaps also to try to answer to the question which was raised into this panel discussion, challenges for tomorrow's EU migration policy. I think that before answering that question, giving some perhaps ways to move ahead, I think that there's one question to answer to. Did we or have we been able to assess the situation we're in today? And my fear is that the answer is no, and more particularly a double no. We haven't been able to assess properly the situation. we are facing not a crisis, but crises. Inside the EU, with the economic crisis, of course, but also outside the EU, Europe's neighbourhood is facing increasing instable situations which are creating, as you said, enormous flows of people fleeing for their lives. So this is one evaluation which needs to be done, and so far I'm not entirely sure that we clearly have done that one. The second one is that have we been able to plan what we are going to do in the future? And the normal mode, which would be the one that should be implemented by decision makers, would be to be able at one stage to sit and to think about what is going to happen in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years in the world with respect to human mobility. And so far, I am afraid and I am sad to say that this hasn't been done. The fact that the world is changing, the fact that human mobility today will not be the same tomorrow due to the high number of elements has not been taken into consideration. The economic situation is one, the demographic one is also one, but instability in regions of the world, the digitalization of the world, access to and availability of natural resources, which is also a source of numerous conflicts around the world, climate change, which is driving on the roads of exiles an increasing number of people, the urbanization of the world, as well as the rise of the middle class, all these elements are going to have a tremendous impact on human mobility worldwide, and in this regard, too, and within the EU, and we are playing the game as if nothing will change. And I think that we have not been able today, it was the task of the European Council a while ago in June, it hasn't performed that task, it will be perhaps the task of the European Commission to sit and to think, it might be the task of the European Parliament to take up that moment to sit for the next 18 to 24 months and to evaluate what is going to, on how is human mobility going to look like in the next couple of years in order to adapt our own policies to this major challenge, which is going to be the one we will have to manage, human mobility. So far, we have not done this, and so far, we have been able to develop policies at EU level which could be considered as inward-looking and unambitious. Inward-looking policies, if we have a look to the common European asylum system, it is perhaps the best system in the world in terms of protection, but it only functions once you are in the EU territory. Before entering the EU territory, you are not protected, and the European Union, despite its efforts to help countries outside of the European territory, does not have what we call a protection policy. How do we help people fleeing for their lives because they are killed at home to get a safe access to a protection? This is something which is discussed, but this is something which has not happened today. If we have a look to migration policy, it is mainly driven by security concerns. Border management is something which is high on the agenda, which has triggered a lot of measures. But on the other side, legal migration, which is also something we have to deal with, nothing much has been done. If we want to be clear about it, we have had this selective approach, or to quote some MEPs, the salami approach. We are just targeting some categories of third country nationals, but nothing is coherent in this regard. So I think that we are facing now a moment where we are in a situation where we need to clearly think what we have to do. And I would say that there are maybe three ways we can start clearly thinking about. The first one, which is existing but not to the extent it should be, which is intra-EU mobility. intra-EU mobility of legally residing third country nationals is only awarded to a limited share of third country nationals. If we want to set up a single European labour market where the workforces are located, where it has to be allocated, we need also to think that on our territories, in our member states, we have also third country nationals who may be entitled to move from one country to the other, like EU citizens do. If we want, because this is the big word today at EU level, if we want to be attractive, let's try to think from outside and put our feet into the shoes of a migrant. If I want to move to the EU for work purposes, and with the exception of the selected text, highly skilled workers or seasonal workers, I want to move to the EU to work, I am facing 28 different legislations, which is not the case if I want to move elsewhere to the US, Canada, Australia, and so on and so forth. So if we want to be attractive, we need also to think about a common scheme with common conditions in order to say people who want to move to the EU, to France, Belgium, Spain, Italy, etc., need to fulfill those conditions. This does not mean that we are going to withdraw the sovereignty of member states to decide about who is entitled to be attributed a residence permit. It is just to say that we are a group of states having decided to set up a common, I hope, future. Now, let's try to have common ways of thinking about admission of migrant workers. Finally, and this is going to be my final word, I think that the events we are facing and coming from France, you are well aware of what happened a few weeks ago in France, which also triggered my attention on the fact, what are we going to do now? Are we going to retreat for security reasons? Or isn't it time today, given the magnitude of the shock this has created into the French, but also European and worldwide population, to think differently? And why not to think about a U-turn? We have been able, over the last 40 years, to establish a freedom of movement principle and rule. We know how it works. EU citizens are moving from one country to the other. This has not created major problems. This has not created, despite current discourses, waves of people coming in one country or in another. Just remember that when Spain and Portugal acceded to the European labour market, a lot of Spanish and Portuguese citizens went back home because they knew that they would be able to go back again. Let's think about a sound, a clever partnership with our first neighbours, allowing them to move within the EU along the lines of what we have been able to do with our own citizens. I think this would be a real people-to-people policy, which is claimed for in the GAM, but which has never been clearly implemented. Let's think that our neighbours are neighbors, whatever their nationality, whatever their religious belief, whatever was going to happen tomorrow, and that we need to live united. We have been able to do so in the EU. We should be able to extend the area of peace and freedom with our first neighbors. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Eve, as always, going straight to the heart of the matter. I just want to come back to you on one part of this, which is intra-EU mobility and the argument that's made that this would make Europe more attractive to third country nationals. Because I always have a little bit of trouble with this, because I don't see any evidence for that, that people are attracted to the EU because they would have the ability to move around. If you look at EU citizens, the vast, vast majority are not mobile, despite, as you say, the debates across Europe. It's really, we're talking about 3% of people. So one assumes that the vast majority of third country nationals are not also going to take up those rights. Now, on the one hand, that reduces the political worry about the impacts of intra-EU mobility. But on the other hand, would that be a game changer? It would require an enormous political capital to achieve intra-EU mobility. I think even for high-skilled workers, as we saw with the negotiations of the blue card, But third country nationals are attracted by particular sectors or clusters or particular locations, not even countries, but cities within countries. They're attracted to particular locations. How would intra-EU mobility really be a game changer in terms of attractiveness? Should we not really be working on building up our creative or other industries, our R&D, and places that would attract the top brains from around the world?
Well, I think that intra-EU mobility is not the solution. It's one solution. And I am not sure, and this is not the way I've portrayed it, along the lines of attractiveness. I think that we need to consider that since we are trying to set up a single European labour market, we are having a situation today where we have a group of EU citizens who are benefiting from full freedom of movement, and we have some third country nationals residing legally in our member states who have perhaps the qualifications needed to occupy one position in one member state or the other, that could perfectly fit for the job. And if we just open up that possibility and the possibility for third country nationals legally residing here to move within the European Union, this could perhaps be an attractive element, but this could also be a positive move ahead for the single European labour market, for its efficiency and its building.
So the benefits are for the EU as much as they are for the individual migrant. That's good to know. And turning last, but certainly not least, to Shada Islam, who's the Director of Policy at Friends of Europe and a former colleague, I'm proud to say, who has an extraordinary knowledge of a wide range of policy issues, particularly with respect to Asia, but you have closely followed the debates on Muslim integration within the European Union, questions around the narratives of migration and what it means to really understand community cohesion across Europe. So I'd be interested to see where you see us going in the future.
Thank you very much, Liz, and good afternoon, everyone. Three quick words of caution. I don't think of migration all day, unlike my three colleagues here. I do think of Asia. I think of the WTO. I think of NATO. I think of Europe. So I was drawn into this debate after 9/11, largely because of my name. And since then, of course, I have focused on it and tried to understand, as you said, Liz, the narrative situation especially. Second word, I don't really like narratives. I think we use it a lot in this city. I'm more for stories and perhaps for arguments, but, you know, we'll talk about narratives. And thirdly, my colleagues Eve and Matthias and yourself, Liz, have painted a very sane picture of what Europe could be like if it thought in a rational and sensible fashion. It doesn't. When it comes to migration, unfortunately, the debate is hysterical. It's explosive. It's dynamite. There's no sanity in it. And I think what all of us are doing are trying to bring a bit of responsible, lucid thinking into this. Eve asked a very good question. What are we going to do now? And what are we going to do now? Are we serious about this? Because it is. It is very serious. And I'm going to tell you why I think so. First of all, this is not going to be an easy task. It's not going to be easy for the Juncker Commission, for the European governments. It's going to be extremely difficult. Eve talked about Paris. There's also the economic crisis, that in unemployment, fears of globalization. European citizens are very worried about globalization. Nobody in the EU has told them the good side of the story, the positive side of globalization. Here, we're really worried about what's happening outside and how it impacts on our little Europe. You've got the Islamic State. I mean, you know, they're creating devastation, havoc across the world. I would say the world, not just the Middle East. And, of course, we have this very disturbing development of foreign fighters, which again has sort of added into this rather poisonous brew that's going on there, if you like. Of course, we've seen the rise of the far right and their debate, and even more, I would say, disturbing than the rise of the far right, God knows that's disturbing, is how mainstream politicians are buying into this very, very hysterical discussion. There is no sanity coming from any European capital, except, I have to say, recently from Angela Merkel, from Germany, when she had to respond to the phenomena of Pegida. So when you're outside Europe, as many of us are, you ask yourself, who speaks for Europe? Who is dominating the agenda, the political agenda in Europe at the moment? And I've just come back from Asia, and you know who it is? It's Geert Wilders. It's Viktor Orban. It's Marine Le Pen. It's Nigel Farage. And you do hear a miracle, of course, and thank God. But really, these rather hysterical men and women are dominating the debate. They're charismatic, and they get it, and the media plays into it. So the conversation is extremely difficult to change. It's a vicious circle. And I think what I find also in this city, I have to say very disheartening, is the EU silence on this issue. I'm not saying the guys are not trying to do something. They are. But it's so soft, and it's so quiet, and it's so forgotten in this maze of different initiatives that we've heard through the day. That message is not getting through. And I'm disappointed. I have to say I'm very disappointed. And of course, Liz, you mentioned it, Lampedusa, the asylum crisis, how this is affecting our moral high ground that we, you know, like to stand on when we talk to the rest of the world. My second point is it's urgent. We can't keep putting this off. It's been 15 years since I've been sort of looking into this discussion. And you said, have things changed? I'll talk about how things have changed. It's not all bad. But, you know, the debate is stuck and we need fresh new incentives to try and break that vicious circle. The argument for why Europe needs immigrants, we've talked about the skills gap, we've talked about the economic benefits, we need skilled and unskilled labor, and you know your plans you guys are putting forward are excellent, but who's actually thinking about it and implementing them? Where is the sanity in this discussion? Now, when you travel across the world as well, and you realize, really realize how what happens within Europe, the internal dimension of Europe, impacts on its external profile, its internal, external reputation. Really what happens, the way we treat our refugees, our asylum seekers, impacts on how the world sees us. And if we're going to have any credibility in this world, any global standing, when it comes to talking about minorities, human rights, women's rights, we will lose it if we don't practice what we preach. I think it has to be a collective initiative. You can't just expect policymakers to do it. It has to be entire societies, right? It has to be Muslims, scholars, religious leaders, civil society, business, and of course media as well. Okay, so what are the positive developments that I've seen in the last few years, 15 years if you like? There is a stronger focus on integration in policies. It's not just about security. It's the security paradigm is there, and we've seen it now with the foreign fighter debate, but that's not all. So I'm really heartened by the fact that we are talking about anti-discrimination laws, integration, and these are very important steps forward, I would say. There is better surveillance of radicals. Better surveillance of radicals in mosques, in prisons, on the internet, etc. And we're seeing that. Of course, Paris was terrible. But there are many other Parises, I think, that have been averted because our security services are working harder. There's better exchanges between them. The third point is that I think European Muslims, actually that term is not a good one because it's not a homogenous lot, you know, very different, but are more aware, more savvy. 15 years ago, when 9/11 happened, it was a shock to the system. I think since then we've got used, Muslims have got used to the fact that there is a certain degree of disconnect, suspicion, and that there has to be a more active citizenship approach taken by Muslims in Europe. So I think if you look around you, you will see that there is a much more active participation by European Muslim communities in this debate. My final thought is really about what needs to change. What are the ingredients of a new narrative on integration? What are the basic ingredients that will make this a success? The first thing is actually very, very simple. You have to get away from the fact, you have to get away from the perception that European Muslims are foreigners. You have to get away from the fact that European Muslims are not from outside. They're insiders. European Muslims are European first and foremost. And that is something I think that is so important in many, many communities across Europe, the fact that this is not an alien presence. These are not foreigners. These are members of our societies. And this is active citizenship, part of Europe. And I think I've written something about this, actually. This means that non-European Muslims, non-European Muslim leaders should stop trying to meddle in the lives of European Muslims. I think this is going to be very, very important. You saw that in Paris. These guys turned up, mostly guys, from all across the Muslim world, standing up for freedom of expression and against repression, against terrorism. I mean, sorry, but these people came from some of the worst repressive countries in the world, and they were standing there in Paris. What do they have to say to European Muslims whose concerns are about Europe today, about jobs, about education, about being part of society? European Muslims' interests and concerns have nothing to do with what's happening outside of the Muslim world. The connections are growing weaker. I know we talk about how people travel back and forth, but the real connections, the sentimental connections are there. But the real day-to-day connections, I think, are growing weaker. So that, I think, is a first very important step, Liz, that has to be taken. And if we do that, it means really that the debate on who's them and who's us will change. It'll become a much more inclusive debate. I think, and I'll really stop now, European politicians face the challenge of turning this into a more rational, sensible discussion. Get away from all this hysteria and focus on facts. And if you look at the difference between facts and reality and the myth and perceptions of what immigration has meant for Europe, you'll see the difference between what people are saying and what the reality is, even, in fact, in terms of numbers. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay. And I think one of the arguments, Liz, that I hope will become forward is the contribution made by European Muslims, by migrants, to the business, to the economy of Europe, whether it's through businesses, employment, whatever. But this is something that we need it, and we don't talk about it often. So I think if we actually sit back and think with cool heads, and get away from all this, you know, us and them, and they're bad, and they're coming in. I mean, it's not now just about Muslims, it's about anyone who actually comes up from outside, whether it's Bulgarians, Romanians, or whatever. I think if we do that, we break this vicious, vicious, hysterical, toxic circle, and we get into a more rational debate. But as I said, when I talked about what Eve and Matthias said, it's going to be very challenging.
Thank you very much for a passionate discussion of these issues. I want to come back on two aspects. One is, you know, the idea of focusing on facts and moving away from myths. And I think one of the challenges is we have a lot of facts, almost too many facts, that are used by all parties to a debate as bullets that fly past each other rather than as a conversation. Yes. And some recent research from British Futures in the UK highlighted how the uncertain middle, not the polarised ends, right, who are pro or against, but the uncertain middle is tired of being talked to about immigration and wants a conversation with policymakers about immigration, and that facts are no longer meaningful because we have so many of them and we don't know which ones we should be relying on. So what role can the EU play in ameliorating that situation of a surfeit of facts that no one trusts? And as the EU is one step removed from publics on a daily basis, the advantage is I think there are a lot of cool heads in Brussels, less hysteria, perhaps. Some people might disagree. But how does the EU contribute robustly to this discussion from that remove and into debates that change their parameters and are very nuanced from country to country and even within countries from region to region? How do they contribute effectively to that debate? And if you have any thoughts on that.
Yes, I do have thoughts, and I think it would be really important for the European Commission, which and the Parliament, and of course the Council of Ministers when they meet, I think it would be really, I would say, so encouraging if they came up. There are studies, I'm not saying they're not studies, and there has been work done on these things. The contribution migrants have made to European economy, the diversity, the talent, you know, all these different things. It's all there. It's all there. It's not that it's not there. It's just that it's not verbalized as it should be. It's not political as it should be. And it isn't brought into the mainstream conversation as it should be. We have a European year of diversity. We have a European year of multiculturalism, a European year of development. I mean, it's all there. It's the intentions, I think, are good. I think the intentions are good. There's the right sentiment. Something has to be done. But none of our people in Brussels, within this beltway, have said anything that I would stand up and say, wow, that makes sense, and that's something that needs to be tweeted about, Facebooked, whatever. I find that sad, and I think there are some very good voices in the European Parliament, frankly, very, very good. But it's, once again, it's a niche topic. So I would like it, really, and I think we're well-placed, the think tank world. I mean, you guys are doing brilliant work on it, and we're all trying to sort of feed into this more rational debate. But we need to make that a much more political, strategic security issue, not just because there are potential terrorists out there, but because it's important that Europe has credibility as a diverse and multicultural continent.
Thank you. And I now have a new challenge for myself, which is to say something interesting enough for Sharda to tweet about me. 2015 New Year's resolution, everybody. So I'd like to open this discussion. You have the gentleman there with the papers in the air, and then two down here, and then the lady at the back. If we take them in a group, and hopefully we can do two or three rounds of questions. So if you'd like to introduce yourself before you speak, that would be really
okay.
Helpful.
Okay, thank you very well, Sharda, for what you have said. My name is Mohammed Rajai Barakat. I was Arab immigrant until 9/11, and since 1911, I am a Muslim immigrant. Even if the last time I prayed for Muslim gods, it was 30 years ago. Mr. Yves Pascal, you spoke about the negative effects on public opinions, the negative effects of migration. Don't you think that if we explain to our public opinions the good effects of migration of Europeans to Arab countries or to other countries, the benefit effects of migration of multinationals in third world countries and what they are doing there. For example, in one of the countries I know so good, Jordan, all companies, national companies who work good, like telecommunications, cementeries, potash, phosphate, all these things, are under the control of French, British, Belgian multinationals. Don't you think that if we explain really to our public opinions in Europe all these realities, they may change their opinions? For migrants who are coming here, you know, I am a scientific migrant. I came as a study at the university, and I stayed. I found a very beautiful Belgian wife, and I stayed with her here. For these migrants, you know, now all many migrants who are coming here, it's because of poverty, and big part of poverty in third world countries are because of us Europeans here. About what's happening now, the war and the migrants who are coming from Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Palestine, and all these countries, we are responsible as Europeans. Well, now I am a European citizen. We Europeans, we are responsible because we are part of these conflicts. We begin the war in Afghanistan and then in Iraq and then on all these other countries. Well, I'll stop here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sir.
John Richardson, German Marshall Fund. At the beginning of this debate, it was said several times that the discussion on legal immigration had been submerged by the refugee problem. I think quite correctly. More recently, however, I think both have been submerged by the events in Paris and the reaction to them. So I was very pleased that Sharda brought this element into the conversation. And just as an aside, if I may say so, if what Sharda said is an example of the Islamization of Western Europe, then I'm all in favor of it. At the time of the events in Paris, I would have stood up too and with a placard saying, "Je suis Charlie," because it would have been showing solidarity with the right to free expression of opinion. When the next edition of Charlie Hebdo came out, I would have liked there to have been a movement where I could stand up with a placard saying, "Je ne suis pas Charlie," because in my view, every right brings with it responsibilities. And one of those responsibilities is to respect the differences of the other groups in your society. And if we don't push in that direction, then the events of Paris and the reaction to them will have introduced a further divisive element into our society rather than leading to it being more cohesive.
Thank you. If we can just take one more question from the front here, and then we have several ladies who are waiting to speak here. We'll come round in a second round.
Yes, thank you. My name is Shivko Zeleskov. I'm still a graduate student at Maastricht University. You talked about, the first two speakers talked about intra-EU mobility, and they were fairly optimistic in terms of what's coming ahead. I fail to share your optimism for one reason or another. And to be honest, I think that the member states along the southern and eastern borders of the European Union have faced a large challenge in the last few years. And that has led to major issues in some member states in terms of treatment of refugees and of illegal immigrants. And they received little, if any, assistance by the other member states. And in the end, that led to blurring lines in some member states between the between illegal immigrants and refugees, which is very, very problematic. Although we have the directive on reception conditions, the reception conditions, for example, in southeastern Europe are very, very bad. I've personally visited a center for asylum seekers in Bulgaria, and I know from personal experience how bad the situation is. So I was wondering what your comment might be on the fact that for example, there are EU institutions such as Frontex who commend the actions by the Bulgarian authorities along the border with Turkey and are very, very supportive of their actions. And then we have the Fundamental Rights Agency in Vienna who are very critical of the same actions. How would you comment on that problem, that issue, how to overcome that doubling of institutions, the different points of views that are expressed at the European level, but they need to be somehow systemized, as well as my second question is, I've been a student in Britain, so I personally know what the situation might be when you're a foreigner in a country. I've been there for 4 years, and I was one of the people that organized the For Equal Student Rights movement in the UK for Bulgarian and Romanian students. So I was wondering what your opinion might be on how to overcome the boundaries of thinking in the society itself, both in the more developed part of the EU, the northwestern part of the EU, and in the southeastern part of the EU, where the society is getting very, very anxious about the situation as well. Thank you.
Thank you. I think if we'll try and go from this end, Eve, if you start, and we'll come across this way.
Well, I think that there are many, many points that I'm going to try to limit myself to two of them. If I get the first question right, should we portray the positive effect of migration? If I didn't misunderstand, well, I think that we have here an example which is a sad and not to say a worrying example. What has been said over the last couple of months and years about intra-EU mobility or the freedom of movement of EU citizens? We have here in this room two former commissioners dealing who have dealt with this issue and who have spoken on a daily basis about surveys, about evidences that freedom of movement is a very good thing for the EU, and they haven't been able, even in political terms and even on the basis of studies, surveys and clear evidences that it is positive, to overturn the idea that we may be facing a wave of Romanians or Bulgarians and so on and so forth. So I think that the problem with migration-related issues is that we are in an irrational discourse, and the problem is that you can bring all evidences you want, you can bring all evidences you need. People will start again bringing into the debate false issues or big ideas which are going to be taken on board by the others, and it's going to be extremely difficult to deconstruct one negative discourse about migration. The problem, and I think this is perhaps the main thing we have to do, and this is not my idea, and I would have loved to have it, but this is an idea which is shared by a lot of people, and in particular by François Crépeau, the UN rapporteur on human rights, who says it's a pretty simple thing. In order to bring some coolness or to bring some cool heads around the migration debate, you have to put a face on migration, because migration is perceived as a phenomenon which has no face, something which is frightening people. As long as you put a face on someone that you consider that he or she is a human being, then things are far more different. The fact is that all Muslims are dangerous people, with the exception of my neighbor Mohammed. I know him, and he's not like the others. This is as simple as that. But as far as we will not be able to put a face on migration and to think along the lines of a threatening phenomenon, it is going to remain an irrational topic. Well, I think I'm going to stop here to leave some space to the others. Otherwise, I would have been too long on different issues. So
you remind me that a few years ago, I asked a series of journalists, why don't you report more on migration from Brussels? And they said, you have no idea the argument I have with my editor trying to get a boring press release from the European Commission into a daily news cycle where there's nothing human about what is being said about the migration policy. We can talk about Sangat, we can talk about Lampedusa, and we can write about that. But we can't deal with another directive that doesn't really tell us what the impact and the human impact. So there's also another side of that in communicating, I think. Matthias.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for your questions. There were many important points raised. I would like to focus on two. And first, I think we need a holistic view on migration, like taking really into consideration the entire complex picture of it, and getting away from these labels of like economic migrants, refugees, and illegal migrants, with the economic migrant being great and wanted, the refugee, maybe not, and the illegal migrant, they're very bad. So if you take a look at many people that face difficult situations in their respective country. It might be politically, but it might be also just economic poverty. So their only perspective they might see is to try to migrate and find a better opportunity somewhere else. But many of them really poor people, they're not able to qualify as economic migrants. They don't have the qualification that employers in Europe might want. So they end up with traffickers in the Mediterranean, with also people that are really classic refugees in the political sense, that they're trying to escape conflict. Those people are actually then economic migrants, if you strictly speaking. So I think we really need to have an honest, clear debate on what kind of channels we offer. Of course, there need to be a clear channel for people that try to escape political conflicts, qualify for asylum, but also, of course, there need to be clear, attractive channels for legal migrants. But, I mean, this is, of course, there need to be many improvements. But, I mean, there we have achieved quite a decent level by now. But also the illegal people that don't qualify for these high-end titles, we really need an honest and frank and mostly fact-based debate, if possible, how we can help those people to get out of irregularity and really go into legal channels. Leave it at this point. Maybe very briefly on this issue of fear Shada talked about, but also it came up in some of the questions, because I think many big source of the skepticism of people in Europe is that they're worried about themselves, their job situation, their children, their social mobility. So these are kind of these diffuse fears. And then, of course, migrants are a nice scapegoat, especially maybe Muslim migrants. So it's extremely important that we, even though it is very difficult to really kind of try to go to the concrete problem of what it actually is and really try to lift those fog of those diffuse fears and actually say, okay, we need to create job opportunities and decent labor market opportunities for people at home and separate those fears from migrants in Europe.
Thanks. I think it's also important to note that while we may talk about economic migration, the dominant flows of migration to the European Union are family migrants joining workers who are already in Europe and humanitarian migrants, people fleeing conflict. But there's no need to create a strong barrier then when we talk about labour market integration and skills development and recognition of qualifications, which should apply for all the populations and not just those who come through strictly economic channels. And I think sometimes we get caught up in our debates. We're talking about asylum now, so we're going to talk about this strata of issues. We're going to talk about economic migration now and this strata of issues. We need to think much more broadly and break down some of those silos. Shada.
Yeah, just a couple of points. Eve talked about the need to put a face on migration. Eve, there are faces on migration in sports and the art world, in politics. I mean, if you look around you, in a number of our European governments, there are ministers, high-level policymakers from foreign background, migrant backgrounds. There are. Stuff is happening. Real progress is being made. In the last 15 years, there's been a sea change in attitudes. Just gets lost because the other side is so loud and so horribly toxic that the benefits, the good things happening, are forgotten and sort of buried under this rubble, if you like, coming from the others. So I think that's one point. You know, I was in Pakistan over Christmas, arrived there, and there was Peshawar. There was that horrible massacre in Peshawar. Came back, Paris happened. And you have to ask yourselves, what is happening? And I thought hard about it. And I think what's happening really is that the tentacles of this extremist form of Wahhabi Salafi Islam, which is a very minority orthodox view of Islam, being spread across the world by oil money coming, well, used to be oil money, still is oil money, coming from a very small segment of the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia ahead of it. It's spreading across the Muslim world, and it's spreading into the Muslim communities in Europe, whether it's in France, Germany, the UK, etc. So when you want to stop and you want to counter that, you really have to get to grips with where the poison is coming from. And I can tell you it is coming out from there. It's spreading across the world, and you have to counter it locally, but also on a global level. If you don't do that, the extremist, the very small extremist minority is going to keep getting the headlines, and the others will suffer and be stigmatized because of that. I just wanted to come back to John's point about freedom of speech, caricature, satire, and all that. I mean, I do agree with you. I think we are, when you are kicking an underdog community constantly, there tends to be, I think, in any community, a reaction which is not always amused, which is not always of amusement, if you like. So I think we have to be slightly careful. I'm a journalist myself, believe in free speech, satire, caricature, but I think there is a time in societies where you have to at some point say, kicking the underdog, kicking the victim, kicking somebody who already feels rather bad about himself, bad in his or her skin, is that useful? Is that cohesive? Is that inclusive? Or is that going to just build in, buy in to this this kind of superiority that we can feel because we believe the way we believe in free speech, we do believe in free speech. And just remember, I think it's important, how many members of the Muslim community actually do share that same point of view. Many, many do. People are not out on the streets. This is a big change from the caricatures of Muhammad that were published by the Danish. Then, you know, there was a general uproar and outrage, and I think people were really, really hurt, felt insulted. Many did, many didn't. Many didn't. And the same thing now, but I think more European Muslims are much more Europeanized, if you like, you know, and it's water off their back for many, really. So I think we need to come to terms with also when we talk about reactions, many are actually just thinking, oh, well, another insult. Oh, well, another caricature. Doesn't really matter. Life goes on. You know?
Thank you, Shadow. The lady at the back. The lady in the black cardigan with the white. You. The lady here. The gentleman here and the gentleman here. And I'm really sorry. Then we can go to a final. And if I can ask you to keep your interventions as short as possible to allow for as many questions. And introduce yourselves. I have so many directions as chair. It's quite complicated.
Hello, Sophia Kabir, Friends of Europe. I have a question about the integration aspect of the migration debate. as well as in connection with the European Muslim community. I very much appreciated Shada's point about the very irrational hysteria around this debate in Europe at the moment, but I think what has fired up this debate recently has been the phenomena of homegrown radicalization and foreign fighters, because when we looked at the profiles of, when the media analyzed the profiles of the foreign fighters, and also, for example, the brothers in Paris, it was astonishing how integrated they actually were and how objectively they could have been considered as success stories of European integration policy. They were educated, they spoke the languages, they went to sports clubs, they, I mean, yes, there was no obvious reason for them to react in this extreme way, which confused, I think, everyone in Europe and has unfortunately fed the fear and spread even more fear in the European community because it didn't make any sense to anyone. How would you explain this phenomenon? And should we there again look at ourselves and blame ourselves and say we failed to integrate them enough? Or is this a whole different animal, perhaps?
My name is Maya Fuch from the SWP. To Matthias Meyer, in your paper you write of matching the qualifications of migrants. What do you mean exactly with this? I mean, when a ship comes from Africa with migrants, would you then have a database with the qualifications, with how you want to match them exactly? Thanks.
Sir.
This one.
Yes. Again, I could not ask you for the floor because I think I'm in paradise. I'm not in the capital of Europe this afternoon. I mean, looking at this panel, I think, my God, if the world could be like this panel. A great French man who is saying the truth. A German man who is saying that Europe has to go the right way. A Georgetown lady and a London-based lady that are speaking, that should speak to elected people below, I mean, in the southern Mediterranean neighborhood. But I have a question. Europe was asked by Africa 5 years ago during the summit of Lisbon by the president of the African Union, who was the president of Senegal, when the Accord de Partenariat Commerciaux, APC, Commercial Agreements with Africa, ended, Africa has proposed to have APD, Accord de Partenariat de Développement, in order to sell prime raw material. Africa was proposing, let's transform it locally and sell to Europe. Let's develop the countries. Unfortunately, Europe at the time has refused the APD. Today, there are no agreements between the European Union and Africa. This is a fact. So, yes. So, what is your view? Maybe, and Mr. Pasquo would understand me and maybe excuse me, if I said there is a difference in behavior of France when it deals with Africa, because it was a former colony, and although all the French people were not in favor of colonization, that trait is still distinctive there. The German Minister of Foreign Affairs was in my country, Tunisia, 3 days ago. He was talking about co-development, about creating riches together, about investment, the way the Vice President of the European Union was saying. When we hear the President of France coming, he's talking about buy arms, we will sell you airplanes, you will fight this. Of course, we want to defend ourselves. I was a member of parliament. We were tracked by those guys who wanted to kill us. Those guys who are misusing the word Islam. They killed my colleague, Mohammed Brahmi, with 14 bullets. But that didn't stop us voting our best constitution, 200 votes out of 216. Total equality between men and women, freedom of religion, freedom of belief, etc. So Germany is behaving one way, France is behaving another way. Isn't it time in the European Union not to delegate to France the relationships of Europe with Africa? Yeah. Thank you.
Yes, Giles Merritt, like Shada from Friends of Europe. I have a question for the panel. What's the plan? I was thinking about, it's more than 20 years since I produced a discussion paper on the lack of an EU immigration policy. Nothing's changed. Well, actually, one thing has changed. We now know we have a serious labour shortage coming our way. We need to import between now and mid-century roughly 100 million people. We have no idea how we're going to integrate them and whether or not countries will allow them. So as you've all said, the EU doesn't have a plan. What should it be?
I'm sorry for all those who have questions to ask, but we are finishing up now. In our last 5 minutes, I'd like to ask each of our panellists to respond to that last round of questions, starting with Shada.
Yeah, on the question of well-adjusted young men, my perception is different. I think these murderers and criminals and terrorists were actually already involved in crime. They were, had already spent time in prisons, had been further radicalized while they were in prison. A number of the foreign fighters who are going to ISIS and others are coming back really disillusioned. They went there in search of adventure, as young men and women have done through the years. They were recruited by very nasty recruiters in the internet, etc., coming back. And I think Gilles de Kerckhoff yesterday said something really, really important where he said, let's not automatically put them in prison and treat them as criminals. Let's actually try and correct what went wrong. If I could just say one thing, you know, we talk about a lot about foreign fighters and, you know, potential terrorists, the fifth column and all the rest of this nonsense one hears. If I'm right, and I think this is correct, Liz, there are more Muslim migrants in European security services, police forces, defending our common heritage, like Ahmed was doing and Charlie Hebdo. There are more Muslim migrants in the police forces than they are actually trying to gun everyone down. So I think we need to remember that. Giles's question about what's the plan, I think it's very simple, really, just to send out the right message about inclusiveness and to say we need, as you just said, Giles, we need immigrant labour. We have a massive skills shortage, labour shortage, and how are we going to fill it? We need foreign labour. They are a positive, constructive contribution to Europe's future and Europe's diversity. We need, and this I will say again and again, role models. We need role models within the EU institutions. Look around you. Apart from the European Parliament, Liz, how many people of ethnic descent, ethnic origin are there inside the European institutions? We talk a lot. But are there really? Has there ever been any commissioner, head of cabinet, major policymaker who has been of, let's say, migrant, foreign descent? We don't even have a term for it. We don't even have a lexicon, a word that we use for people who are born here but are foreign, what, families or descent or whatever. I don't have a name for it. So the plan should be to actually find a name and then find some really strong messages to send outside about how we are building a multicultural and diverse Europe. We should celebrate it, not denounce it, I would say.
That's certainly a conversation you and I have been having for most of the last 10 years, and it seems that the European institutions are moving more slowly than actually the national and local government.
Absolutely.
In terms of representing the new populations, well, the real population of Europe. Matthias.
Thank you. I will address the question that was specifically asked to myself on the matching. What I actually meant, I was talking about classical legal economic migration channels. So, for instance, if an Iranian doctor comes to Germany, he or she should be able to work as a doctor or as a lawyer, whatever. Because, I mean, this was a massive issue in the past that very qualified people in the home countries, great professions, great careers, were forced to, in much lower skilled jobs than they were qualified for. So there has been some progress, but of course it's a key point is that the qualifications are recognized, and if they are not recognized, then it needs to be clear what is missing, and there need to be clear channels on how those missing skill set can be acquired in the respective country. This other point, you mentioned the people in the boat. I mean, this is it's a different thing. I mean, what I mentioned, what I tried to say earlier is that we should really have a serious debate on and put some brain power in how we can avoid those people end up in the boat in the first place. And yes, and then ideally the matching process will be the same as with people that go through legal channels. And very briefly, one point on this on the plan or what has been achieved. I think, especially in the realm of legal migration, there has been maybe slow slow and not linear progress on the European Union level. But we have some legislation like the Blue Card or Directive on Student, Long-Term Residence, etc. So maybe we now still need a bigger vision, but we also need to just continue this path. And I think we also, what is important for member states to actually use those existing legislation, like the Blue Card is actually a good title. But maybe I'm a bit proud to say, but Germany, when I wrote my PhD dissertation a couple of years ago, Germany was always the laggard in migration and was really, really restrictive on migration. And for instance, the UK was then much at the forefront and very open. But in a couple of years now, it has really changed. So Germany, to my great surprise, actually implemented the Blue Card in a quite generous way. So I think in 2013, 15,000 Blue Cards that had been issued across Europe, there was 14,000 in Germany. So it's also really that it's important to use the existing instruments we have, but of course a great vision maybe of the Juncker Commission can't harm.
Bear in mind that the Blue Card came along a very useful time for a German government struggling to do national reform.
Yes,
so EU
yeah.
policy actually managed yes, to yes. to fill a gap. Eve, over to you.
I'm going to try to answer two questions in the same answer. I think you're right, there is no EU policy as such. We have a huge set of rules organizing specific situations of different set of people, but there are no policy as such, i.e. where are we going, how and why. And I think that to answer this question, we need to consider several points first, and this is my position, sorry for this, but I think that nowadays and given the trend of human mobility and where we are standing today, the migration policies should be dealt at EU level. I think this should become an entire EU policy. On this basis, I think that there are four steps which need to be taken. First, to define, as I said previously, what are the challenges we are facing and we will be facing. And this is clearly a first step to assess where we are, what we have, where we are, where we are going. Second, to define objectives. Where do we want to go? What do we want to achieve? And I think that there are at least two objectives we need to work on. This is my own opinion. Mobility to and within the Union. And protection. Protection has a double meaning. Protection of people in the EU, but also protection of people outside the EU in need of protection. This done, we need to connect the policy fields inside migration policy, not only behaving on the basis of a silo approach, international protection, irregular migration, legal migration. We need to consider that these policy fields act and interact together, and this is a nonsense to act in one field without taking into account the others. But also, and this is related to your question and comment, we need also to think outside of the migration policy field. If it has to become an EU policy, we need also to think what is the impact of other EU policies on movement or forced movement of people. What is the impact of the common agricultural policy in third countries? What is the impact of EU development policy in third countries? What is the impact of EU trade policy in third countries? And whether this has an impact or not, or a sufficient impact, we need then to think migration policies with those policies also on board, i.e. at EU level, commissions responsible for those portfolios should also take that into account. Finally, at EU level, we need also to think migration policies within the current institutional framework. It is as if we were
continuing thinking about the institutional triangle, the Commission, the Council, and the Parliament. There are two other institutions which are now extremely important, the European Court of Justice for the implementation of what we have today, and the role of the Court of Justice will become, from my own perspective, increasingly important. But what is going to be the role of the European External Action Service tomorrow in these fields? Which means that if we want to think about migration policies tomorrow within the framework of the institutional framework, we do not need to think on the basis of an institutional triangle, but we need to think on the basis of an institutional pentagon. And these are the players we need to have in mind when we want to set up a proper EU migration policy.
Thank you, Eve. I think you've hit on exactly the challenges facing the EU, particularly in the immediate future. We did some research at the end of last year on the various policy programmes on migration in different parts of the European Commission and discovered that there wasn't a single person who knew everything that was going on. Everyone has a fragmented view, so I think there's a lot of remedial work that needs to be done before you even have a baseline to build greater policy. I'd like to thank all our panellists, and I'd like to thank you for listening so attentively this afternoon. And I think if I can allow myself the liberty of answering your question, which is what do we do with an EU migration policy? What should that look like? I actually think that rather than replicating national policies, we should think about the added value role of the European Union. What can the European Union do that member states cannot do by themselves? And there is a lot there, but it is not about replicating existing migration systems at great expense and complication. It's not about trying to think in terms of rigid numbers. I think this 100 million figure, well, if you think about the fact that most migrants are very mobile in the modern world, you're actually talking about 200 million people over a period of time to fill the labour markets. If you think about it as 100 million people in the labour market, it quickly becomes an overwhelming idea. So how can we think more holistically, think about the fact that we do not realise the potential of a large proportion of immigrants who are already within the European Union. We fail to do that. And think about the other policy levers you use in conjunction with migration. This is not all about migration policy. It's about other mainstream policies like employment. Education is absolutely critical, and we haven't mentioned it today, but you've got urban areas where more than 50% of the children in classrooms are coming from immigrant backgrounds. So we have to rethink our education systems from the bottom up. This is a much deeper and broader set of policy needs that we have across the European Union, which I think you're starting to get to with your idea of skills development and partnership, and Eve is getting to with holistics. But nothing will change unless we can actually create a more positive and rational debate on migration. And having tried to sum up very inexpertly the perspectives of our various panellists, I'd like to thank them all once more, and thank you for listening. Good afternoon.